Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
John the Baptist and I had an odd relationship in primary school. Because of my failure to grasp the purpose of the Father, the little sign that tells you to lengthen a vowel in Irish, I found it hard to distinguish between words such as bóistíoch, rain, and báistíoch, baptism. Most 10-year-olds growing up in Dublin would take this phonological confusion in their stride, but my circumstances were different. My old primary school, Belgrove National School, was known in Irish as Scoil Ón Báistíoch, the school of John the Baptist, for the very good reason that it's located in the parish of St. John the Baptist. For me, the closeness of the two words bóistíoch and báistíoch meant my child's imagination conjured up a version of John, who, despite spending much of his time in the desert, was somehow a permanently rain-sodden, bedraggled figure. I imagined him alone, crying in the wilderness, glumly preparing a meal of locusts and honey, while his own personal rain-laden cloud hovered close overhead in an otherwise blue sky. Other details of his story also caught my imagination. I felt for his aging parents, who'd given up hope of ever having a child. I was intrigued by how the babe leapt in Elizabeth's womb when Mary came to visit. I was puzzled by his relationship with his distant cousin Jesus and his self-effacing announcement that he wasn't worthy to untie Jesus' sandals. I certainly didn't feel like that about any of my cousins. My heart went out to him. There, I felt, was a man who hadn't had a fair crack at the whip. There was a man who, if he were alive now, would benefit from an assertiveness course. Years ago, when I started spending time in the west of Ireland, I realised that perhaps I wasn't alone in feeling he had been undervalued. I discovered that St. John's Eve, the 23rd of June, was a special date in the Connemara calendar. It was the custom, I was told, in parts of Connemara and elsewhere, to light bonfires on hilltops and headlands. While I suspected that this practice was more likely to be related to pagan celebrations of the summer solstice, I had enough affection for the old faith to want to persuade myself that these bonfires were part of a nationwide programme to grant a saintly man a little bit of the recognition he had shunned during his life. One summer, more than 30 years ago, my neighbour near Roundstone told me that he'd been assembling materials for a bonfire at Crucón an Túrin. It was years since he had lit a bonfire. It was going to be a big bonfire, he said with pride, and I should come along. Even though I knew well that Sean's first language was Irish, I did the unforgivable and took the opportunity to correct his pronunciation. "Do you mean bonfire, Sean?" He didn't bat an eyelid. "Well, it's tine crov in Irish, so there must be a bone in there somewhere." Unlike my manners, his etymology was beyond reproach. I learned later that bones were indeed frequently placed in bonfires, St. John's Eve bonfires and others, hence the term. When I joined him at his bonfire on Crucón an Túrin, he was alone, drinking from a can of beer. He reminisced about how in the old days people would say prayers around the fire. There would be music and singing. The young men would vie with one another to jump back and forth through the flames. Cattle would be driven through the dying embers to ward off disease, and the embers would then be placed in a corner of a field to help the crops. He wasn't sure if he believed in any of that now. He was just doing it for old time's sake. Nobody else was bothered. Sure, this might be my last. It was his last. He died a few years later without ever setting another bonfire. St. John's Eve belonged to the old times, like so much else in his life. His strength as a curragh rower counted for nothing now that everyone had an outboard motor. His skill as a set dancer, of no value now that everyone preferred television. Last year, St. John's Eve, around 7 in the evening, I stood near the southern tip of Inishnee and checked the coastline from Glinsk to Letterard with binoculars for signs of a bonfire. I could see nothing. I walked up the hill at Kinraver to get a better look. I thought I could see a plume of smoke a few miles to the south near Half Mace, but that was all. A poor showing. Sean was right. Nobody was bothered. A few hours later, I decided to head out again and climbed another hill that affords an almost uninterrupted view of Roundstone, Errisbeg and Bertreboy Bay. Although it was nearly 11 o'clock at night, it was still essentially daylight, bright enough for me to make out the colours of the fields in Letterard across the bay. As I reached the crest of the hill, I felt my heart lift as I counted 4 bonfires on Errisbeg, a gentle north wind blowing smoke out towards the sea. There was one over at Cashel, and a further 5 along the stretch from Glinsk to Carna. A particularly bright fire was burning furiously down near the shore, more than 2 miles away at Collamore. If Sean had been alive, he would have been able to see it easily from his favoured vantage point, just leaning in the doorway of his house in Kinraver. It was a beautiful sight, and it would have lifted his heart too. I thought to myself, fair play to John the Baptist.
I'm John the Baptist, and this is my friend Salome. And you can bet it's my head she wants, and not my heart only. If you see me smiling, you wonder why.
I keep a knitting carry beside my side of the sofa. In this knitting carry are not half-finished jumpers or the cast-on stitches of a pair of socks, but rather a jumble of books, words knitted together in novels, crocheted into short stories, or embroidered onto the pages of a poetry collection. Right now, my caddy contains a volume of essays from Irish writers, copies of the Irish language magazine Core, poetry collections in Irish and English, receipts from a shoe shop, and several notebooks. The knitting caddy also has 2 front pockets, probably intended for keeping spools of thread, embroidery needles and thimbles. But I've stuffed pens and highlighters into one pocket because the best books should be written on. The other pocket has bookmarks. To be clear, I'm not a bookmark fundamentalist. I have been known to keep my place by dog-earing the page, by sticking a pencil in the book, using a receipt, an unopened antiseptic wipe, a tag from a pair of pyjamas, or, to the horror of book lovers everywhere, other books. However, in a life that involves so much reading, both for business and pleasure, bookmarks tend to accumulate. I take them out of the pocket and spread them like a hand of cards. A Victoria and Albert Museum bookmark that I got for my 29th birthday. A bookmark memento from a friend's recent wedding. The fancy magnetic ones that I picked up in Hodges Figgis in Dublin. These magnetic ones seem to me to be the no-nonsense operators of the bookmark world. They snap onto the page, tight as a kiss lock on a purse. You can throw the book haphazardly into a bag and be in no danger of losing your page. I imagine these bookmarks rolling their eyes at the flimsy paper Doolittles who fall asleep on the job and have to be fished out from the grit at the bottom of a rucksack. I've never been a fan of the elastic bookmark, however. Who wants a thick, stretchy band holding the page for you with all the tenderness of a wedgie? And other examples. A solemn, sword-bearing Angel Raphael gazes up at me from the gilt bookmark I bought in Christchurch Cathedral. And I've got bookmarks that aren't bookmarks at all. A vintage postcard sent from Cork on the 30th of April 1911 with a picture of a cat on the front. All good wishes. I know you're fond of cats, says the script on the back, writ before my great-grandparents were born. There's also something special in buying owl books and finding the previous owner's impromptu bookmarks between the pages, musty and fine as pressed flowers. I opened my second-hand copy of An Duineach, Dineen's Irish Dictionary, and found numerous articles about Sean Lamass's economic policies, clipped out and stuck between various pages. I found reviews of the Patrick McGinley novel Goosefoot, which had been scissored out from the newspapers and slid between the pages of the novel itself. And multiple bookmarks from bookshops, Dubray, Eason's, Kenny's, and especially from Charlie Burns in Galway. I love it when the booksellers ring up the stack of books and then stick a bookmark or two into the pages, like your granny slipping a 50-euro note into a birthday card. And my owlist bookmark, the one that says the most. A leather slab from the Ulster American Folk Park in Tyrone, from a school tour when I was 10, back in 2005, back when you felt the need to scribble your name on everything. I slide it out of the book I'm currently reading, Misha Raftery and Feodor Fuckel by Tadhg McConaghan. I flip the bookmark over and still discern Lucy Costello, 4th and 5th class, Murlough School. I've also written my old home phone number and, in case I got lost and needed to hand something over to a kind stranger to show where I lived, Calhame, Ballandrate, County Donegal. All of this in childish, round letters, parts of it written in blue marker that has bruised into the brown leather over the years. 10 years later, in 2015, I wrote the Irish version of my name, Leashach Ní Chostila, in black biro as well, the letters slanting forward in confident, Clo Gaelic, the Gaelic script. The elongated R shape of the S, the punk Sheviha over the C for the rasp of Chostila. 10 years later again, in 2025, I thumb the edges of my owlist bookmark, trace over the letters of my two names. I take up Misha Raftery again. I'm nearly finished. And I slot the bookmark back into its rightful place. I tidy up the bookmarks, slide them back into their pocket in the knitting caddy, and I get up from the sofa.
As the championship in hurling and football gets to the important stage, we've spent the last months packing the lunches and loading children into the car to head to a town somewhere in pursuit of All-Ireland glory. And even though the island has shrunk thanks to the motorways, it can still be quite a jaunt and still maybe involve an overnight stay to see your team in action. I recently headed off on a solo run to see Down play Clare in Ennis, Sunday afternoon match. A 4-hour trip for me. Family were all away for the weekend, so I decided to go on the Saturday afternoon and stay over. Now, in the olden days, you'd have gone to the Bord Fáilte brochure, found a St Bernadette's or a Mount Carmel B&B with vacancies in the town, and rung up, spoken to a human being, and booked. Not now, of course. So I sat in the kitchen, opened the laptop, and went through the online accommodation options. Not much was available on that Saturday afternoon for that night, but one place immediately stood out, describing itself as a cabin in the woods. Sure, wouldn't a cabin in the woods be lovely? I thought, re-commune with nature and all that. but reading the listing more closely, I saw it was billed as a work in progress, a garden shed with bare wooden walls, bare wooden floor and a fold-up single bed on the edge of a forest with no electricity or running water, and under facilities, the line that stood out to me was, there is a hole in the ground for the needful. Now, I was only looking for a bed for the night, but still in all, the hole in the ground for the needful was not on my bucket list. So I kept on scrolling. And I'm not fussy. I've stayed in some kips in my time, a split-level bungalow in Donegal that was indeed split-level in the sense that the top level was a house with no heating and the bottom level was a cowshed with lots of sleepy little flies that were so glad to see us. And then there was the night not that long ago in Derry when after a football match, a great night out and a green coat that went missing with the house keys in it, myself, my wife and my brother-in-law found ourselves sleeping the whole night in the car. Me in the driver's seat, wife in the passenger seat and the brother-in-law stretched out in the back. And it's a funny feeling, bedding down in your car, parked outside your house, in your drive at 2 a.m. on a cold night in the middle of winter, knowing that you're all going to be there for the next 7 hours. And so, up for whatever adventure might befall, that Saturday afternoon last month, I booked a room in a house, closed the laptop and hit the road on my own with a song in my heart, podcasts and playlists and snacks for the journey, and sure, the time flew by. Arrived into Ennis about 8 on Saturday night, wandered round the town, maybe more American tourists than Down supporters there, grabbed a bite to eat and a pint, and off to bed for an early night. My room was less than ideal, I have to say. No lock on the door, a lingering smell of wet dog, and a pile of somebody else's clothes on the other single bed in the room. All part of the adventure, I know, but when the banattee asked what time I fancied breakfast in the morning, I politely declined and said, I'll get up early and get out and find somewhere myself. Thank you. Sunday morning dawned bright and sunny and warm, and I found myself listening to the radio, crawling behind slow-moving caravans and lycra-clad cyclists on the winding road through Ennistymon to Lahinch. Sure, I was in no hurry. Lahinch provided a memorable breakfast that filled me for the rest of the day. I took time to look out at the big sea and the Atlantic rollers sweeping in as the world passed by on the prom. Then out along the coast to Spanish Point, bathed in sunshine, looking very posh. Sunday Mass was on in Milltown Malby. A dog sauntered across the street in front of me and eyed me as if to say, I live here and you don't. Willie Clancy piping away silently on the main street. Miriam's talking to Simon Le Bon on the radio. And all the time I've one eye out to see, would Sharon Shannon or Davy Spillane or Marty Morrissey or Stockton's Wing just happened to be coming out of the local shop with Maura O'Connell and a bag of sausages and black pudding for the breakfast. Vogue Williams is having a great chat with Brenton O'Connor as I roll back into Ennis in good time and get parked 5 minutes from the pitch. And I make sure to follow an ancient tradition of, even though there's hardly anybody at the match, making sure the car is pointed for home. Not my first rodeo. And I head in for the big match. It's been a long 6 months since the start of the year. I got a tan in Ennis. I got a soaking in Enniskillen. And I've spent many happy Saturday evenings in Park Essler in Uri. So let's take a moment to just thank the players, men and women, footballers and hurlers, in anticipation of whose skills and dedication we have loaded up cars, made sandwiches and traversed the country. Míle buíochas Ó Chrí. You may indeed talk of Columbus a-sailing across the Atlantical Sea, but as I travelled West Clare on that sunny Sunday, there was no one as happy as me.
He was standing on the corner I wanted to tell you about visiting Monet's garden in Giverny. I wanted to mention the heart-stopping beauty of the cherry blossoms, all pink and white, the shimmer of bluebells at our feet, and everywhere apple and pear trees in full bloom. I wanted to mention Monet's house, the green shutters and pink stucco walls exquisitely set amidst all this glory. I wanted to mention that Monet created his art twice, once in his garden and again in his paintings. And I also had to get in somewhere that the landlady of our small French bed and breakfast was an opera singer who sang for us on the morning of our departure. But mostly I wanted to write about the joy there is to be had in being with friends you've known all your life. Friends who belong to that innermost intimate circle where nothing has to be explained. These friends know all about you, your family, your children, your siblings, your ex-husband. They even know the name of the dog you had when you were 10 years old. And best of all, and somewhat miraculously, despite knowing all this, they still want to hang around with you. The store of memories you've built up together over the years is the gold on which these friendships survive. The comfort there is to be had at the retelling of these memories, the good and the bad, the happy and the sad, cannot be measured. So, how to capture all this in one short piece? Well, back to Monet's garden. Giddy with the profusion of beauty all around us, we three friends stood among those cherry blossoms looking back at the Monet house. We noticed a small wooden platform or porch which led out from the front door. It was the kind of place you could sit in the evenings and watch the sun set behind the Japanese footbridge when the wisteria is in full bloom. The kind of place where the Monet family might gather with their friends on a blue-starred evening, sipping champagne. The kind of place where Mrs. Monet might step out from her chores in the kitchen to call out to her husband that the lunch was ready. Claude, viens, ton déjeuner est prêt. We imagined Claude Monet sitting by the lily pond at his easel, a paintbrush in one hand, calling back to her. Oui, je viens bientôt. And then there was our landlady, the opera singer. Not understanding how precious an instrument is the human voice, we had boldly asked her to sing for us. I am not sure if "Ah, go on," entered the conversation, but knowing us, it probably did. But Madame had declined all our requests with a dismissive wave of her very French hand. But on the morning of our departure, she surprised us by saying, "Aujourd'hui, I will sing for you. I have prepared my voice." She put the palm of her hand flat against her diaphragm, took a deep breath, fixed her eyes on a far distant point, and began to sing Puccini's "O mio babbino caro." The tears still prick my eyes when I remember the majesty and power of that voice. It filled that small dining room and floated far over the fields to Monet's garden, over his Japanese footbridge, over the water lilies, and north towards Paris and the River Seine. We three Irish women were transfixed. Any time we got together after that, the conversation would eventually turn to Giverny and Madame Monet coming out to her porch to call, "Claude, viens, ton déjeuner est prêt." And then we dissolve into kinks of knee-bending laughter, driving mad, I'm sure, anybody who wasn't part of that Monet trip. And then, on cue, our eyes would mist over at the memory of our landlady singing Puccini's rapturous aria. And now, 30 years later, our little Giverny group of friends has been reduced by one. Now there are only two of us left who remember our imagined scene of Claude Monet and his wife. Now there are only two who, when we hear Puccini's aria, will be brought right back to a time when we were young and full of hope that friendships last forever. So what I am trying to say here in my long winding way through the north of France, through cherry blossom trees and Japanese footbridges, is this. Cling to those old friends. Cling to your glory days with them. Cling to those memories, because nothing lasts forever. And as John McGahern says in his memoir, All Will Be Well, the precious life is everything.
Oh, When I got booked to perform with the Stephen Frost Improv All-Stars at Glastonbury Festival in Somerset, it was a dream come true. I had one guest ticket, so I brought my son. We flew to Bristol on his 18th birthday, and he bought me a pint in the hostel that night. Next day, we got the bus to the festival, arriving on Thursday to a mucky mess. We trudged and slid through the soft earth, rutted by tractors and trucks, still setting up the main stages. With a large rucksack on my back, guitar in one hand, a bag in the other, damp boots on my feet, and the rest of me dripping with sweat, I joined the festival throng. Somehow, everyone seemed to know where they were going. The place had the air of a makeshift prospector town, populated by a horde of glitter-sprinkled gold diggers. The mud reached right up to the makeshift vendors' cabins selling Wellingtons, rainproof ponchos, pink fun fur jackets and cowboy hats. Other vendors sold food from every part of the world, noodles, crepes, pasties and paella. I slipped and bumped into a squat, dreadlocked, tattooed native, spattering him with mud. "Oops, pardon me," he smiled. I smiled back wordlessly, not knowing how to react to such politeness. My heart did a somersault. I was 53, newly single and covered in mud, and this was my first Glastonbury festival. Glastonbury has history. The first festival, hosted by Michael Leavis, took place in 1970 for 1,500 people with T-Rex as the headline act. Now, a couple of 100,000 people come every summer solstice weekend to Worthy Farm, near the town of Shepton Mallet. And that year, I was one of them. After we watched Muse together, I let my son slip off and spend some time with some people of his own age. Frightened to death to see him take his first steps into this unknown world, I asked a girl who was probably all of 20 to look after him. And by the time I was seated around a campfire with some fellow performers on my second pint of scrumpy, I was sure he'd be just fine. If I never have another Glastonbury, this will be enough, I thought. The cider drowned the lonely pangs of regret that I wasn't sharing this moment with someone close. I love my own company, but I'd like it if someone else would love it too. It turns out that wasn't my last Glastonbury. I've actually been booked every year since, so last year, with 2 hours sleep and a faint glow in the sky, I turned the ignition in the old diesel Skoda Octavia. Packing the car with tent, duvet, pillows, Wellington boots, sleeping bags and a guitar, we set off for the 7 a.m. Rosslare ferry to Fishguard. Hitting 60 makes us both rattle a bit, the Skoda in miles and me in years. Heading to a festival now requires homework. What will we listen to when we're on the way? Avril Lavigne or Lancôme? Dua Lipa or Jarvis Cocker? Kneecap or Charlie XCX? And how can the Sunday headline be an act I've never heard of called SZA? I've become an old fogey, definitely. Having said that, at the age of 60, my father would certainly not have been off to camp at a music festival. Not with cows to milk and hay to save, and a complete lack of interest in any popular music past Perry Como or Andy Williams, or at a push, Johnny Cash. We rattled to a halt in the belly of the Stena Line ferry. We joined the hodgepodge of rumpled voyagers climbing the metal stairs, find a bench in the canteen, cover ourselves in the open sleeping bag, and rock-a-bye baby to sleep on the moving ship. 5 hours later, we're driving across the Prince of Wales Bridge from Wales to England, and the sun is shining. I'm not with my son this time. I'm with my new wife, just months after our wedding. So yeah, somebody did love my company. We pick up our laminates and set up a tent in under an apple tree in what's called the orchard, the performer's camping area. It sounds idyllic, but it's not. It's an uneven field dotted with spindly trees, and I'm not going to see Elton John coming out of his tent next door to wash his teeth at the one available water tap, or Dua Lipa stroll over to the Portaloo toilet roll in hand. Nah, My neighbour will likely be a tightrope walker or a street performer who will later lope towards the festival hordes on stilts while dressed in pink pelican plumage. At 2 p.m. on Friday, I take to the Astrolabe stage with the Steve Frost All-Stars. Steve Frost, Andy Smart and Richard Vranch were stalwarts of the festival. They were there when alternative comedy was being invented. Steve and Richard were regulars on Channel 4's Whose Line Is It Anyway? Andy Smart loved festivals. He was at every Edinburgh, every Glastonbury and every Pamplona festival for 40 years. He died 2 years ago. This is already our second year taking to the Astrolabe stage without him. I'm holding my wife Nerea's hand and I don't take one bit of this for granted. We're watching Lancome who sing, "When young people dance, they do not dance forever. It is written on sand with the softest of feathers. It is not written stone like the walls of the chapel, and soon it is gone like the soft winter's apple." It's our third Glastonbury together, but we'll treat it like our last.
For the past few years, my social media feed has looked like one long obituary filled with faces of fallen soldiers. Graham Dale, the Irishman who was killed in Ukraine in December of 2023 while fighting the Russian army, did not exist in my world before his death notice. The irony is that while I found safety and refuge in his home country, he went straight into the battlefield in mine. What made this Dublin-born warrior abandon his comfortable life and go to fight the invaders? This decision can be traced back to its roots in the book he wrote called The Green Marine, An Irishman's War in Iraq. Over 20 years ago, Graham obtained a green card and moved to Texas, USA. The world was soon shaken by the massive September 11th terror attacks. This is when Graham felt prompted to join the U.S. Marines and defend, as he put it, a way of life that was now his. He drew inspiration from the example of his great-grandfather, who had faced the Germans in the trenches of the First World War, some relatives on his mother's side, who fought the English to free Ireland, two uncles, who served in the U.S. Army, and others. He said he respected the fact that they had the courage to fight for their convictions. I was fascinated by the description of his deployment to Iraq. At times, I was holding my breath, or my tears, as I was delving into his book late at night. At other times, I was laughing out loud while reading it on my long bus trips to Dublin. I learned the name of his first love, and that he would often fall off the top of the bunk bed as a child. This tendency didn't change when he became a Marine. With awe, I observed the scene where he and his squad members were doing everything possible and impossible to save a wounded fellow Marine. Covered in blood, choking from smoke and spitting out the wounded soldier's vomit while performing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as part of the CPR, Graham wouldn't stop until the evacuation helicopter arrived. I then knew that he would not give up until he'd done everything in his power, and even beyond that. What mattered was that we were brothers, and we had stayed together to the end, he wrote, looking at his experiences retrospectively. Graham had a hard time after the completion of his mission to Iraq. Not only did he suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, but he was also questioning himself and was questioned by others about his feelings regarding such a controversial war, where, as many voices said, dollars prevailed over other geopolitical motives. Fortunately, a certain somebody called Killer helped with his PTSD. Killer was the name of his Chihuahua dog that in one day did for Graham
what doctors and counselors had been trying to do for a year, he explained. As for his attempts to find the meaning of the war, he wrote, "I am bombarded by media reports from all sides, and official statements and general opinions. I am confused. I guess it would be a little easier to live with if the scars had been inflicted after fighting a conventional war that had clear goals and front lines, where the object was an easily defined cause, like freeing Europe or even defending a smaller country from aggression." For Graham, the war in Ukraine met those criteria. Years after his first war, he joined in with humanitarian efforts in Ukraine. And soon, despite being all too familiar with what war-related PTSD felt like, he enlisted in the Ukrainian army. Once again, Graham couldn't sit by and watch the terrible events unfold like it was a daytime TV drama. He fought for his convictions, not just for the lands, but for European values of freedom, equality, justice, the rule of law, accountability, and transparency. He might have realized that for some, this war is also perceived as controversial. Different narratives are fighting their own battles against each other. Propaganda is the number one weapon of totalitarianism, and it works in all languages. The Ministry of Truth, as so well described in Orwell's novel 1984, is working nonstop to rewrite history. Different voices might bombard our minds and influence opinions, but I still know that Graham Dale was doing the right thing. "My war is over," he wrote in his book. "I had done my bit and had done it well." How sad it is that he didn't get to write a sequel. It is now up to the rest of us to write it, making sure that we don't let the reality depicted in 1984 spread over Europe and beyond.
On this morning's programme, we heard Fair Play to John the Baptist by Conall Hamill, Marking the Pages by Leisha Ní Chostála, Travelling West by John Toll, Visiting Monet's Garden for Ethna was by Maeve Edwards, Glastonbury by Joe Rooney, and Graham Dale's Wars by Antonia Gunko Carolina. The music, John the Baptist by John Martin, Éirí na Gréine by Steve Cooney, Bed for the Night by Maura O'Connell, Puccini's O Mio Babbino Caro, sung by Angela Giorgio, and Glastonbury's song by the Waterboys. You can listen back, if you like, on the RTE radio app. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.